my niece's office.
That's a good reason. That's a good reason.
Yeah.
We still have guests around us.
Oh, so you won't be able to go over there?
No, she's not.
Oh, Sharon, tonight.
Yeah.
You're counting down the days. So I hope all of you had a wonderful Thanksgiving and had a nice time. My parents are here, so they're visiting. So
I was
well.
Asking if they were part of the group. But you didn't bring your grandfather.
No. That's right. They saw Amital when she was just...
The wrong generation. We want the little generation.
That's right.
Amital was here for the first 6 weeks or so.
She was here for the first 6 months.
Yeah.
Amital was a trooper. The first 6 months she was here. She was good. So, no.
So they're staying with you.
Yeah. Where are they?
My parents live in Tennessee.
Yeah.
Born. That's where I was born. But
in Knoxville or something?
In Johnson City, close to Knoxville. So yeah.
My niece is at University of Tennessee.
There you go. So yeah. So they came for the holiday. They leave tomorrow. Okay, so we're gonna begin. We're talking today about the status quo agreement. And I'm assuming for many of you this is relatively new information in terms of the status quo. So we're going to unpack a little bit of the details surrounding the status quo. But before we went into the details of the status quo, I just wanted to make sure that we had at least some working knowledge of the different streams of ultra-Orthodox Judaism that were in Palestine during the period of the Yishuv, as well as playing out in the early formation of the state, and then we see remnants of that exist still today. So one is, and I wish I had a whiteboard here or a chalkboard, but one is the community called Mizrahi, Mizrachi. And the Mizrahi community, also known as Merkaz Ruhani, right, so the center of the spiritual center, was originally founded in 1902 in Vienna by a man named Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, R-E-I-N-E-S. And if you recall from some of the earlier Hertzberg chapters that we read in the Zionist Idea, one of the precursors that he has in that book is Rabbi Reines. Reines created Merkaz Ruhani, and it really was the first religious party to declare itself as religious and as Zionist. Now, is that a contradiction, or are those terms compatible? It's a contradiction. So why is it a contradiction?
Because only Mashiach can declare Israel.
That's right. So if you're an ultra-Orthodox Jew, what are the three essential components of your religious identity?
Torah.
That's one.
You're waiting for the Messiah.
Right, so God, right? God. And there's one more. If you're an ultra-Orthodox Jew, you believe in God. So you have to have faith within the Torah and observe all of the halakha, Jewish law. So those are the three essential components if you're an ultra-Orthodox Jew, no matter where you were living, whether it was Eastern Europe, whether it was other parts of Europe, whether it was even in parts of Palestine. And those are essential elements in terms of one's ideological belief system around ultra-Orthodoxy. Now, Zionism, before we go back to a little bit of history, what is Zionism replacing God, Torah, and Halakha with? Okay, a state, a land, a territory, and in this case, sovereignty, right? So a political entity that has power.
And a constitution.
Okay, so man-made laws, that's a natural tension because the other laws were given by God in theory. What? Well, right, we don't have one yet, but the idea of, right? The idea of laws that govern a people, and those laws are not going to be divinely ordained. And what about instead of God?
The head of state.
The concept of peoplehood.
People.
That's right.
Democracy.
The idea, not democracy, but the idea of the idea of a nation, the idea of people. And that people, as a collective entity, replaces the notion of God. Right? So if we read the Declaration of Independence, and I can bring it in next week unless someone... Actually, do you have Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
And that the Jewish Agency Executive inform you of its position on the issues you raised and stipulate what it is prepared to accomplish regarding your demands on said issues within the limits of its influence and decision-making powers. The Jewish Agency Executive has appointed the undersigned to formulate its position on the questions you mentioned in the discussions. We hereby inform you of the Jewish Agency Executive positions. A. The Sabbath. It is clear that the legal day of rest in the Jewish state will be Saturday, obviously permitting Christians and members of other faiths to rest on their weekly holiday. B. Kashrut. One should use all means required to ensure that every state kitchen intended for Jews will have kosher food. C. Marital affairs. All members of the executive recognize the serious nature of the problem and the great difficulties involved. All bodies represented by the Jewish Agency Executive will do all that can be done to satisfy the needs of the religiously observant on this matter and to prevent a rift in the Jewish people. D. Education. Full autonomy of every stream in education will be guaranteed. Incidentally, this rule applies in the Zionist Association and Knesset Yisrael at present. The government will take no steps that adversely affect the religious awareness and religious conscience of any part of Israel. The state, of course, will determine the minimum obligatory studies, Hebrew language, history, science, and the like, and will supervise the fulfillment of this minimum, but will accord full freedom to each stream to conduct education according to its conscience and will avoid any adverse effects on the religious conscience. Sincerely, on behalf of the Jewish Agency Executive, D. Ben Gurion, Rabbi Y. L. Fishman, Y. Greenbaum.
Mm-hmm. So what's the first response then that you, before we go on into read? We know that it's four things that are going to be a primary concern in the status quo agreement. The first is the personal matters, meaning marriage and divorce. That's what personal status they're talking about. The Sabbath, Shabbat, education, and kashrut. So let's take each one sort of step by step. So, Shabbat.
Well, he says it's a legal day of rest.
Yep.
It doesn't say it's going to be Shabbat, like we understand it in worship,
That's right.
In religion.
So there's no expectation that people are going to go to shul. That's not an expectation. If they want to, great. They don't have to.
But is there expectations that all the rules, that there's no public transportation? And
that's right. So the rule is that in terms of the legal day of rest in the Jewish state, what that means then is that public governmental realms won't be working that day, right? They'll be shut down. So public transportation.
Banking.
Right. Banking. Any governmental offices. Those are all closed. Now.
It says in the Jewish state.
Yes.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody has to do it.
No, there's no way. First of all, he's only talking about Israel.
Right.
This isn't about outside of Israel.
No.
But the idea is that you have this one day of rest, and this day for the Jewish state is going to be Saturday.
It's not telling all shops that can't be open. It's just saying that those that are government-run
any government involvement has to be closed, right? Anything the government provides on a regular basis won't be operating on that day. That's why you have taxis that run by them, right, that are operated. Those are privately owned. If you have a car, you can drive it. You're not going to get taxed for driving your car on Shabbat, right?
No, but the store thing, like in...
The store thing is different.
Because like in... Right, so...
So here's where the store thing is different. Because it's a day of where things are supposed to be closed, you have to apply to the government for a permit to be open on Saturday. The cost of that permit is exceedingly high today. And then I'm sure it wasn't cheap either. So if you want to have a store open on Saturday, it means you're going to have to pay a very high price in order to keep it open. Now, the rabbis who have involvement in the government make this a purposeful challenge. They purposely are doing that, and they continue to raise those stakes. Because what they don't like is to see that those stores are open because they're engaged in commerce and making money and all this.
Is a restaurant considered commerce also?
So, the restaurant is tricky. If you're a restaurant that's open on Shabbat, you're not kosher. If you're not kosher, you might lose a lot of clientele that would normally come to you because you're serving kosher meat. You're observing the laws of kashrut in terms of dietary restrictions. But you're open on Shabbat, which means you can't get the vod, the committee, to give you the hechsher that you're kosher. So you have to then think, is it worthwhile financially for me to be open on Saturday when I will then be losing potential customers Monday through Friday or Sunday through Friday?
And the other thing is, like, I'm just thinking about this now, like, you know, Jewish holidays start the night before.
Correct.
So, and I'm guessing they have daylight saving. So, like in the wintertime, does this all start at 4 o'clock on Friday?
Right. So, if you're in Israel right now, so if you're, so I was planning the trip for the Hornstein students to go to Israel. So, what that meant was they arrived last year on Friday. I had to make sure that the last flight that came in was early enough for them to be able to take public transportation, which ended at 3:30 on Friday, for them to be able to make it to the hotel, right? So it does mean that. So if candle lighting is at 4, then about an hour beforehand, everything is closing. And those buses are also shutting down.
It's almost impossible to find a pharmacy that is open on Saturday.
Yep, it's a challenge. Yeah.
So if these stores apply to the government to allow them to be open on Saturday, it costs a lot of money, but what's the likelihood they're going to get a yes?
It is likely. I mean,
it is likely.
The rabbinute in general, the rabbinute is trying to make it more difficult and trying to put more and more stumbling blocks in the way, but it is still very feasible that you can get it. So if you go to Tel Aviv, for example, which is a better example than Jerusalem, you have a lot more that's open on Saturday than you do in Jerusalem. And people feel like our clientele, for the most part, are not clientele that will care if we're open on Shabbat or not open on Shabbat. And so it's worthwhile for us financially to be open on Shabbat and pay the exceedingly high price for that permit. So there are a lot of, for example, convenience stores that are open in Tel Aviv on Shabbat. Just the, you know, a typical convenience store. And the Rabbanut can't stand it. Especially this one particular chain, which is trying to expand and makes it very difficult then when they want to get a building permit. And then the other players are involved and try to make it so that they don't get their building permit, right? So it's not a clean, it's not clean. It's very messy. But it does happen. So Jerusalem's not a good example of actually looking at what's open on Shabbat. Things are open in Jerusalem on Saturday, but nothing in comparison to the way things are open on Saturday in Tel Aviv, where so much is open. You still don't have buses running. You don't have the light rail available or the train in Tel Aviv, because that's government funded. That's public transportation. But, you know, taxis are everywhere.
What about some of the museums that are open?
those are not, most museums are not open, and if it is a museum that's open, then it's a privately owned museum. It is not a government funded museum.
Now, what about the national parks? Because they're all open on Shabbat.
You don't have to pay to get into to national parks in Israel.
Yeah,
not most of them. Most of them are open to the public without a fee. Like Shvil Yisrael, which is the Israeli trail, just walk
on. Oh, I'm talking about like all the, you know, like Masada and any of the, they're called the national parks, and you do have to pay to get in, or are they not?
You don't have to pay to get into Masada. You have to pay to go up the light thing. You don't have to pay to get
in. All the other parks I went to,
you had to pay.
And is that not government run?
Most of those are government run. Most of those are government run. Not all, but most. But also, it just depends. Some of them are under other auspices, so they get away with it. They're loopholes, right? So Masada, for sure, is open on Shabbat, but I don't know. I would have to check. I don't know if it's the same sense of open as it is during the week. I don't know the answer. I can't tell you the last time I was at Masada. Exactly. I don't know the answer to that.
You have to do it on foot.
That's right. So I don't know. Maybe the cable car isn't around on Shabbat. I don't know.
It doesn't make sense, though, because you could have an emergency or something.
Well, for emergencies, all rules are broken anyway for Shabbat.
Yeah, but they would have to run the thing.
Yeah, but you're allowed on Shabbat to break any rule to save a life.
If someone's there to run, you know, I mean, right, well, you just get into difficulties.
Of course. Well, this is the challenge, right? This is the messiness of having a state, period. So this is the piece of Shabbat. Okay, the second piece, kashrut. So why does this piece of kashrut matter? Are they talking about kashrut in your home?
No.
State-run.
So state-run. So again.
State-run entities.
So what's the most important state-run entity?
The army.
Period.
Yeah.
The army.
Yeah.
So does that mean that the whole army
is kosher?
Not just that they offer.
No. The entire army is kosher. No. So the entire army is kosher, right? You would have to go out of your way to not eat kosher meat or kosher food when you're in the army.
Well, non-kosher meat is a lot more expensive.
Yes. But the army, part of it is that the army is the most public component for every citizen of the state, right? Everyone has to serve. So the idea, except Arabs and Haredi, those are the two exceptions. But the idea being that if you have to serve in the army, no matter who you are or what your background is, you shouldn't have to not be able to eat there. Mm-hmm. So everything is automatically kosher. And that's the significance. Right. So it's also... That's right. Because you don't want to say have this person say, well, I'm in the army and I'm defending the state, but I can't even eat here. That's a problem.
So does that mean with the army, obviously Saturday nothing happens, does that mean you can't turn on the lights in where you are in the army?
No. It's much more about private space versus public space. So in your own bunker, in your own, you know, you would work it out with your other soldiers and figure out, you know, people's levels of religious observance and make concessions wherever. But it's not about the public space. The public space in that regard is, first of all, if there's an emergency, doesn't matter if it's Shabbat or not in the army, right? There have been certain moments. So, for example, in the 1973 war, it was Yom Kippur, the holiest of holy days. And there are stories letters that they found later reflecting on and saying, you know, I was a soldier in the army. You know, I was in shul at the moment. It was Yom Kippur. I don't eat. I don't drink. I don't write. I pray all day. And I immediately suited up, got in the tank, and got my rifle. Right? So it wasn't even a thought for most of them, even if they're religiously observant, halachically observant. The other place that matters in terms of keeping kosher, governmental buildings, right? So any ministry, the Knesset, that's a kosher cafeteria in the Knesset, those kinds of places.
Schools
are not necessarily kosher. Depends on the school, okay? Because not all schools are government run. So it depends completely on the school system. And that would be the decision makers of those heads of schools. Hospital should be kosher. But I would bet also to venture that most hospitals also probably have kosher and halal now. I don't know if that was originally, but I would bet now that that's an option. But most people who observe eating halal meat eat kosher meat, but it doesn't work in the reverse. Halal is for devout Muslims. It's how they're what they call their kosher meat, right, is halal. Haram is forbidden, halal is permitted. So halal food is permitted food that one can eat. And it's all about the slaughtering again. But if you eat halal meat, right, if you're a Muslim and you keep halal, you accept eating kosher meat. But it doesn't work in the reverse. Mm-hmm. Kosher is a higher standard than halal.
How do they eat halal?
Similarly. No, that's only on Yom Kippur. So that's
but the best thing is different.
Well, sure. So that's the kosher.
But you can see the tension here because this doesn't really bind them to anything. I mean, in
right.
one it does, how you interpret it is, you know, the army, yeah, okay. This government office says that's okay. But it doesn't say we're only going to serve kosher food in Israel.
No.
It doesn't say that.
No. Well, Ben Gurion couldn't get away with saying that.
Say that. Yeah.
There was, first of all, Ben Gurion wouldn't want that.
Right.
No. Ben Gurion is a secularist as secular gets. Ben Gurion's not interested in religious observance.
Right.
He's interested in having conversations with these individuals because it's thought provoking and it pushes him intellectually. But he's not actually interested in observing halacha. So he doesn't want to put a requirement that he knows the majority of the population is not necessarily interested in keeping. He also doesn't want to create a sense in which these rabbis feel some sense, whether it's real or false, of authority and able to make demands on the state that are unreasonable. Right? So this is not a theocracy. He says that in the very beginning. Right? He clearly says it and makes it a point to say this is not going to be a theocratic state. So he doesn't want these rabbis thinking otherwise.
Do you have any sense for what percentage of the population are we talking about, at least at this time, you know, that keep kosher?
So it's hard to know that kind of answer. There are no polls. There's no Gallup poll, Pew poll right at this point in time who's seeing who keeps kosher. The Gutman Report is a entity. The Gutman Institute is an institute that later comes out of Hebrew University, and they do some of those kinds of polls later on. But at this point in time, we don't have any of that kind of information. I'm just looking to see here if I have
And what percentage of the population is he addressing with this letter? In terms of the Alpha.
Well, so this letter is only written to the leadership of Agudat Yisrael. That's who he's talking to specifically.
But is this like 10% of the population in the country, or is
it? It's smaller. But he recognizes. Remember, you have a population that he really understands has to have some sort of compromising buy-in to this entity, or it will become a public relations disaster for this new state, right? If he has ultra-Orthodox Jews protesting the creation of the state of Israel, that is not going to play well.
So would they have leverage above and beyond their numbers?
Absolutely, even at this point.
Because of their ability to speak to the rest of the world about how they're being mistreated in this state.
Well, and not even just mistreated, but also to say, look, here we haven't had a sovereignty since 70 CE, and now we have the chance, meaning we Jews have the chance to create a political sovereignty. Now, Ben-Gurion wants to stop them at that and say, yes, but it's not the Third Temple. Right? He's saying, yes, we do have that opportunity, and it will be a Jewish state, but it's not going to be the Third Temple. This is not going to be a state that has sacrifices and ritual observance and makes demands in terms of religious observance. But this is a state that is going to have the character and the identity of Judaism and Jewishness, and he wants to remain as ambiguous as possible around that, while also making certain compromises and concessions to ensure that that population buys in. So that's a tricky place to be.
Rachel, what do you think the population of Arabs was then? Now we're 20% approximately.
Right. So at this time, you have about 600,000 Jews in 1948. I don't have my table in front of me, but you have it.
1940. It says 1948 A. 700,000.
That's right. So I was going to say between
756,000 non-Jews.
Correct.
But, and the year before, 2 years before, 1,250,000 non-Jews. And then 2 years later, only 150,000.
So who are non-Jews? Who are the non-Jews?
Yeah.
The ones who are left. We're talking about.
We're talking about a million. That's a difference of about roughly about a million people.
That's right.
In how many years? What year?
2 years.
2 years.
Because remember what happened. What happened between these years?
700,000. Supposedly 700,000.
Right. So and so 48. You have about. They're saying here 716,700, right? We say 48 was 600,000 is really the accepted number for the most part, and one in every three is a Holocaust survivor in 1948 of Jews. Okay, so one in every three citizen of the state is a survivor. So the Holocaust, and we're going to talk more about that in the next few weeks, plays a very important role in all of the identity formation of the state of Israel. And the non-Jewish population at this time, in 48, they're saying is about 156,000. And before it was 1.2 million, basically, from 46, right? Now, we talked about how the number of refugees, whether it was those who were fleeing or whether those who were exiled, ranges, there's no good real number, but anywhere between 600,000 and 800,000 of Arabs during the 47 to 49 period who are no longer in this state, meaning Israel proper, that green line that we now know of. And the non-Jews are comprised of Muslims and Christians and Druze. Those are the three non-Jewish populations at the time. And you do see the numbers start to go up again, obviously. But again, it's a huge...
So there was a drop in over a million over 2 years.
Right. That's right.
The non-Jewish population.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like earth-shatteringly large.
It's quite large. Now, also, remember, when we're seeing... when we're seeing the, well, like we read here, and we also heard it when Evan was reading the Declaration of Independence, there is a real conscious effort by Ben-Gurion to make statements like this, that the state will guarantee freedom of conscience for all its citizens and make it clear that there's no intention of establishing a theocratic state. The state will have non-Jewish citizens, Christians and Muslims, with full equal rights for all citizens, and the absence of coercion or discrimination in religious affairs and or other matters. And then also in the Declaration of Independence, they talk about the religious holy sites being protected for each of the respective populations. So that is a very purposeful statement.
So but do these people really have full equal rights? I thought that the Arabs can't vote.
So from 1948 to 1966, the Arab population is living under military government. That's what it's officially called. And under military government, there are certain curfews. And not everywhere. It totally depends on where. So in places where, for example, there's a potential security concern, or especially along border cities, because what you have going on from 1948-49 to about 1955 are border raids constantly between where the area of Jordan is and Jerusalem area, and where you have the Gaza Strip area, which is under Egyptian control, and the western part of, you know, the state of Israel. So those border raids are very violent. These are not small conflicts. These are, you know,
the border raids by the Israelis?
No, these are border raids by the Arabs living outside of Israel against Israel. So much of the army efforts at this point in time are about shoring up defense of those borders, because that's where they're most susceptible to infiltration, and that's where the most pressure is coming on them. And then again, the next war was with Egypt along the border, right? That's what's happening immediately. So those are real pressures, and so those areas where Arabs are living in the state of Israel often have curfew. But it doesn't mean that every Arab living in Haifa is under curfew. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It just depends on the security situation. But they are under a military government. Now, the reason and the rationale for Ben-Gurion to have them under a military government isn't because Ben-Gurion wants to create second-class citizens, but because this seems like a serious fifth column in the presence of the state of Israel. And it's very difficult to know whether or not these individuals are going to accept the state of Israel and become full citizens and relinquish their desires to be in another entity, or if they're going to remain a threat to the state.
So he tells them where they can live.
He tells them what?
Where they can live.
Not so much where they can live. They're still very much concentrated in areas where their villages are. So East Jerusalem stays very much an Arab area, for example. You have mixed cities in Haifa and Tiberias and in the Galilee, because there was still quite a large Arab presence in those areas as well, a Christian presence, which makes sense, right, to have Christian Arabs in those areas. Bethlehem, Nazareth, those are areas, right, that are Christian for the most part. So they're still very much concentrated where they would feel comfortable living for the most part. There, of course, were some moving of population. It doesn't mean they moved them out of the area, but if there was a security concern, then they were not going to be located in that place. And so then you would have a movement of that population. But it wasn't so much Ben-Gurion telling people where they could live, but it was setting certain limits. Until 66, that's when military government is gone.
So he felt that they couldn't be trusted.
There was a huge sense of trust, or lack thereof. Plus, you also, you have these border raids. 50, you have another war. 56, you have another war. 67, you have a war. 73, you have a war, right? So it's not as if it's calm and peaceful and everyone's getting along and there's no pressures that this population is putting on the leadership of the Jewish state. There are very real pressures, especially in that first decade and a half of the emergence of the state of Israel. Now, remember, the old city at this point in time is under whose control? It's under Jordanian control. Do Jews have access to the Kotel? No, not at all. Do Jews have access to all of Jerusalem? No. This is to show that those individuals, like the Jordanians, when they controlled the old city, did not make those places accessible to the Jewish population. Right? So that doesn't happen, where these places are accessible to all populations, until after 67, when Israel has control of the old city. So even with those tensions that exist and still surround it, there was an attempt, one could say, at least by the early leadership of the state, to ensure that there was some opportunity for peoples of different faiths to go to their holy sites and be protected and protect those holy sites from destruction. That has not always been the case. Okay, it is 8:19. Should we stop for about 5 minutes, 10 minutes, take a break, and then we'll reconvene.
I know.
Okay, so we only have about 40 minutes. So we're going to look at the next two pieces as well of the status quo agreement. And I just mentioned just now about Ben-Gurion, and I just want to just say it again, because I really think what's the most important component to remember, that without Ben-Gurion's leadership, none of this would have happened. None of it. And he had incredible foresight and ability to galvanize support around his decisions. And so when you talk about, so if you're a political scientist, which I am not, because political scientists live in, they like to live in these paradigms that they think work without taking into serious consideration people's identity and their cultures and history and individual decision making. So it's hard to really do poli-sci, I think. But when you're a political scientist, you try to remove the influence of the leader as much as possible. But the leadership and the role of the individual who has the ability to make those decisions is absolutely imperative. That's right. And so Ben-Gurion is one of those individuals. And that's why I often say when I'm giving other presentations that the Palestinians have yet to have their Ben-Gurion. Right? They have not found a leader who was willing to make the type of compromises and the decisions that he was willing to make that impacted, obviously, the internal collective Jewish people, as well as then how it plays out on the world stage. And that has not happened to the detriment of the Palestinian people.
Did he just sort of make his way through all the Zionist congresses? And how did he get to this?
Yeah, I mean, so I just said, so there's this incredible biography that Anita Shapira wrote that's very readable, I think, called David Ben-Gurion, that's in the same, I think it's Yale University Press, in the same series as Yehuda Mirsky's on Rav Kook. So you might want to look at that. But he was very smart. I mean, Ben-Gurion was a man from Eastern Europe. His family was from Eastern Europe. He goes to law school in Turkey, right, which was a conscious, like, it was very conscious about what he was doing. And he knew that he needed to understand the Millet system. Remember the Millet system, M-I-L-L-E-T? That's the system under which autonomy communities remain fairly autonomous, especially related to personal status issues. And he wanted to make sure he understood that system, and he wanted to be in a quote-unquote Middle Eastern environment. Because he knew that if there was going to be a future state for the Jewish people, it was going to be there. It was never going to be Uganda, right? Like, he knew that. And so he wanted to understand the peoples, the cultures, the ideas in that particular context.
So all along, he had this thought that he would become...
Right, so I don't know if he knew that he was going to become the prime minister, but he, yeah, that's right, that's right. It's like what Oprah would say, you write it down and then it happens, right? Ben-Gurion was a prolific journal, you know, he had a prolific, he was a prolific writer in his diary, and everyone also says, well, did he know what he was doing, right? Was he writing the diary for himself? And the answer is no. Ben-Gurion knew exactly what he was doing. First of all, it's before typewriters and all these other things. So he took carbon paper on every single page and put it under, would write his entry. And he wrote about personal issues as well, but they're fairly benign personal issues. And wrote about every minutia of decision-making and state-crafting that came into his mind.
It was so... Yeah. Did people perceive him the other way, as a dictator? Sure, there were many
who felt, not dictator, but felt like, who is he to be making all of these decisions on behalf of this future collective?
But that is kind of
like a dictator. Right, look, I don't know how much was George Washington consulting everyone. Right? People make decisions, right? And you either have the leadership ability that you're going to be able to influence, or people will jump ship. And clearly he wasn't dictatorial in that way, because people agree. And as we see from these writings even, there are, he wasn't a dictator in that.
Very political.
Very political, very politically savvy.
It's like every word is well thought out, intentioned.
Right, and it also doesn't mean he didn't make mistakes, right? So he did make mistakes. So, for example, and we're going to get to that, but a good example of that mistake is the conscription in the army, right? Ben-Gurion decided that there would be universal conscription for everyone who was a citizen in the state except for two populations. One population, the Arabs, that's easy. So that was the right answer for that one, right? Because if you don't even trust them to live next to you, you sure as hell are not going to trust them to fire an arm next to you, okay? And then the second population are the Haredi, right? The Haredi. Now, at the time, Ben-Gurion decided to allow 400, seems like a very manageable number, 400 yeshiva students to continue their studies rather than go to the army and serve in the army. And why did he do that? Remember, it's 1948, 1949. So he said, I'm going to give these 400 students the ability to not serve in the army because I think that they should have a chance to revitalize the world that was lost from the Holocaust. That's right, and to study and to learn. So it's an incredible thing. This is a secular man. This is a man who has no desire to observe Jewish law, but he recognized the importance of the tradition that was lost, the lives that were lost, the fact that this was such an unfathomable act of destruction that it had occurred, that there was no way this community was going to bounce back from where it had been or what it had been. And so he said, we're going to make the concession for these 400 students so that they don't have to serve in the army. They have a chance to basically recreate the world from which they came. Okay. Prime Minister Menachem Begin comes along and abolishes the quota. And when he comes along, he says that every person that had the status of a full-time yeshiva student was exempt from any army service, ever. So that was Menachem Begin who pushed it to that next level. So why did Begin do that? Begin comes to power in 1977. So why does he do that?
For political support.
Absolutely, 100%. So there were two parties that he needed support from, or two sectors of society, and we'll get more to this in a couple weeks, so I'm just giving you a preview, right? But what were those two societies? One is the religious. That sector of the population was not politically engaged in the way that the political landscape needed it to be engaged. Because, don't forget, who had been ruling the country from 48 till 77?
Labor,
socialism. The religious are mad. They're mad that they have no representation in a very real way in the political landscape. Now, Begin himself wears a kippah, at least in public, descendant of Holocaust survivors, Ashkenazi European Jew, does not look at all ultra-Orthodox, right? Whether or not he was observant in the privacy of his home, probably not. But he knows how to play the politicking game and get them on his side. The other population that he... Exactly, the Sephardic, the Mizrahi, the North African Jews, the Jews who are not Ashkenazi, because they are going through their own revolutionary kind of moment, similar to the Black Panthers here and what's happening here in civil rights relations. And he knows that he can, which is interesting, he's again Ashkenazi, it's not as if he's Mizrahi, but he does things that some of the labor political leadership never thought of doing. So what's an example of that? He went to a mamuna. What's a mamuna? The mamuna dinner is the dinner that you have towards the end of Pesach, if you're a Sephardic Jew, and it's a very huge, lively celebration to recognize the end of Passover. If you've never been, you should go to one. It's incredible. And every politician now, after Begin, has gone to a mamuna ceremony. Every single politician. Because they recognize that if you want to have any support from the Jews coming from non-European countries, you better recognize the value of their traditions. So that's sort of what Begin was doing. So that becomes important in thinking through what happens for conscription and how this plays out. But it's also, again, what we said. Ben-Gurion, why I say he got it wrong, because Ben-Gurion really did think you'd have these 400 yeshiva kids, and maybe you'd have a little bit more, but it was going to fade. I mean, he really believed it was going to fade.
So even by 1977, there weren't that many Orthodox
Jews? Oh, there were more than 400. I don't know the exact number, but there was definitely more. It wasn't nearly where it had been, clearly. But it had grown, for sure, by 77. But Begin was the one politically who made the move to say all yeshiva students are exempt completely. So that's a game changer once that happens. But it didn't happen immediately, right? It wasn't. So that's something that happens over time. Each prime minister is involved in different aspects of this. It's not so much that they didn't encourage them to pay taxes. They still do encourage ultra-Orthodox to pay taxes. And there are some ultra-Orthodox Jews who do pay taxes. But those who ascribe to the idea that the state doesn't have any right to exist, or those who say we don't recognize the existence of the state, are the ones who don't pay taxes. Because they feel as if if they give any sort of recognition of the state, even by paying taxes or voting, any of those components, then they're compromised. Of course, that doesn't mean that they're not happy to take services from the state. Right. But there are some challenges even with that, right? Here are some challenges. So, for example, there was a period in time in which some of the state leadership said, well, if you're not going to pay taxes, we're not going to provide some of those services. We're not going to pick up your trash, right? And so you had this entire protest around garbage, which becomes a health problem later on, and right. So it's never so straightforward, and it's quite complex in that way. Okay, so let's look at the other two pieces. So marital affairs. So what do we have with marital affairs? What is this about?
Who gets to marry people?
Divorce.
That's right. So it's the rabbi, right? This is where it's leading to. The rabbis are going to have authority over personal status issues. And in this case, we're really just talking about marriage and divorce. We're not yet talking about burial, and we're not yet talking about conversion. We're just talking about the marriage and the divorce pieces, where religious laws are going to govern those personal status issues. And this policy was a continuation, as we said, of the millet system under the Ottoman period. Now, if you're a Christian, same way. It's not that the rabbis govern it, it's that the Christian clergy, the Christian leadership, the Greek Orthodox Church, most often in terms of the population there, makes those decisions over personal status issues for marriage and divorce. If you're Arab, it's the Qadi, the Muslim judge, who makes that decision, the religious leadership, the clerics, over. So it's relegated very similarly to the Ottoman millet system. Well, it's
so Christian, I mean, I'm not talking about Jewish where it's a problem, but so non-Jew, you also have to get married within your church.
Or you're not, that's right, or it's not recognized by the state.
So there's
still no civil marriage or civil divorce in Israel.
What happens still now?
One is Jewish and one is not Jewish.
No,
then
not.
You go out. There's none today still. This is probably internally one of the most controversial issues internally within Israeli society. So if you're an atheist and you're not Jewish and you want to get married and you don't want a religious leader to marry you, you leave the state and come back. You get married outside of the state of Israel and you come back to the state of Israel where your marriage is recognized.
So how would you get a divorce in that situation?
You can't get a divorce in the state unless you go to a religious leadership.
But they're not going to
divorce you
because they would
they
not think that you were married.
This is where the complications are.
Where do they go?
This is where the complications are.
Cyprus.
So, Cyprus is a major hotspot. Cyprus actually has these incredible ads.
It's like Las Vegas.
Yeah, exactly.
Cyprus, Vegas.
That's exactly right. So, Cyprus has these incredible deals. They're called marriage packages. Just like we have honeymoon packages, okay. It's the same thing where you have Israelis. And these can be religiously observant Israelis, right? Meaning, it's just that they're not ultra-Orthodox. So here's a great example. Daniel Gordas. For those of you who know Daniel Gordas and have read his writings, Daniel Gordas is a conservative rabbi. He's a major player in Jewish political thinking and Jewish life, both in diaspora. He writes for the Jerusalem Post all the time. In art, and he made Aliyah. He used to be the head of the American Judaism, whatever that school was in LA, right? Yeah. If you are Daniel Gordas' children, you grow up in a religiously observant home, meaning you're not turning on the lights on Shabbat, you're eating kosher food at every meal, you observe every holiday. So what we would consider probably conservadox / modern orthodox, okay? Daniel Gordas' daughter married a very important person, the son of the president of Hebrew University, also grew up in a very traditional, religiously observant home, not ultra-Orthodox by any means, but just as I described Gordas' daughter. They decided, two very strongly committed Jews who know a lot, that they refused to get married by the ultra-Orthodox period. So they had their father had Daniel Gordas perform the ceremony, who is a rabbi by training. That marriage is not recognized by the state of Israel. They went outside of Israel and got married, came back, and it's recognized by the state of Israel. They only protested it because they wanted to protest the control of the rabbinate, the ultra-Orthodox authority, over the state issue, over civil personal issues.
So do secular Jews get married?
Very rarely.
So they go to Cyprus too?
Yeah.
Every secular Jew goes to Cyprus?
Not every. I mean, very rarely. So many of them will get married in the state, right? Many of them will get married in the state, but it doesn't mean the state recognizes it. So you can have a friend perform a ceremony. Just like here. You can have a friend perform it. You can have a conservative rabbi. You can have a... So, but it's not officially recognized by the state until you have... do it outside the state because you didn't have ultra-Orthodox heksher on it. It's crazy.
Ultra-Orthodox is money.
Is it money?
People aren't doing it not just because of money. There's not.
But there's so many.
Well, so this was actually one of the... When you had the formation of the party Yesh Atid, when it first formed, about 2.5, 3 years ago now, maybe 4... Whatever it was, it's a fairly young party. Yair Lapid was ruling that party. Ruth Calderon, if you remember that name, was in that party. When they were in the government and they were part of the coalition, they felt that there was a moment at that particular time that they would be able to persuade the coalition to create civil marriage and civil divorce. It didn't work. And then the coalition fell apart, and then they're no longer in the coalition. That moment hasn't emerged again, and it's partly because the coalition as it currently stands is very heavily slanted towards those who have more affiliation with the National Religious Party and the ultra-Orthodox population. And so they're not going to cede any of that control to those who are interested in civil marriage.
Okay. For the others, you can go out, but what do you
do? So burials are tricky. So what you do for burials, again, there's personal status issues, meaning you have, if you're a Muslim, you would have the Muslim clergy prepare the body the way according to Islam, Christians according to Christianity, Judaism according, the rabbis according to Judaism. So everyone still has that component of it. The trick actually is around whether or not the state provides certain, especially around those individuals who are in the army or people who died in battle. And the state often likes to put sort of its quote-unquote mark on the tombstone to say that this person... died as a member of the state of Israel, and there are many people who now will take the state to court over whether or not that marking is on the tombstone. Yeah. Because
so have to pay for that?
You have to pay. No, it's part of it, but some people don't want it because they feel as if... Remember we read The Silver Platter?
Yeah.
And remember in The Silver Platter how Nathan Alterman basically says, the silver platter are now your children who are going to be dying for the sake of this place's existence? That powerful poem?
Yeah.
So there are many people who say, screw you, state. Like, you took my child's life at the end of the day. I don't want you to have anything on this tombstone. You shouldn't have a right to put any... This is my child. I decide what's on it. This is my husband. This is my brother. This is my sister. You don't get to say what's on their tombstone. Right?
Yeah.
So that doesn't happen on all individual tombstones. Meaning, if you're an older person and you die, and you're, you know, but it's for those who die in battle, where the state, in some essence, wants to co-opt that death, and say it's in, you know, honor of, and it's part, that's right, it's part of this grand meta-narrative of Zionism. But a lot of people don't want that to be part of their narrative or identity with the state. So that's one way to protest.
So what about Jew marriage and non-Jew?
Okay, Jew marries non-Jew, you're definitely going out of the state. Jew marries non-Jew, you're Cyprus for sure, and then you're coming back. So here's another good example.
And then how do they get buried?
The burial is a good question, because if you're not Jewish, they probably won't be buried in the cemetery.
So a spouse would not be able
correct
to be buried with them. So
unless
they
converted.
Do? Ship them off to Cyprus.
Cyprus.
No, you also have non-Jewish cemeteries.
Oh, okay.
So you put them in the non-Jewish cemetery.
But we're sitting here as American Jews talking about this marriage thing. What do the people in Israel think about it? Do they question it? Or
oh, yeah. Exactly. Like the story I told you. It's much more secular there. But even like the story that I used to illustrate,
yes,
even those who are observant, they may not be ultra-Orthodox, but even those who are observant are protesting.
Right?
So the question, where this becomes the biggest issue is divorce. That's where this is the issue. It's really not the marriage. The marriage is the protest of, and you're frustrated and you're annoyed. But the issue is really two. It's your children, right? And if you are where conversion comes into this, because if you were converted by a non ultra orthodox rabbi in Israel,
your children are
not viewed as Jewish.
Illegitimate.
And so you have a real problem then in terms of what that means. But then it also is the problem in terms of divorce. So for the status quo issue specifically, because we don't talk about conversion and status quo, we only talk about marriage and divorce. For status quo, if you want a divorce, it means you have to go to a religious court. So Christian, you go to the Christian religious court. Muslim, you go to the Muslim religious court. Jewish, you go to the Jewish religious court. You're not going to a civil court. There are civil courts in Israel. There are family courts. There are civil courts. There's a Supreme Court, obviously, which is not based upon religious law. But for those divorce issues, you have to go to divorce. There's no civil divorce court. You have to go to the religious court. Now, this is where you have a problem. If you have someone who's, let's say the husband died, okay? And you want, the woman needs to be, quote unquote, released from that marriage in order to move on with her life. Whether that means certain monetary implications, whether it means getting married again, whether it means whatever, you know, custodial issues over children, right? Guardianship, whatever it is. And if the religious court doesn't release her from that marriage, she can't move on with her life. And she's called an agunah, A-G-U-N-A-H. An agunah is a very serious, agunot. These are women who cannot get the necessary religious requirements in order to have a complete religious divorce. And basically, it means they are chained to that marriage, even if the husband is dead, even if the husband... So a good example was this woman, it's this incredible story. Yeah, so this woman is married to a Jewish man, both Jewish, and the woman's husband is sent by the Israeli intelligence, because he was an intelligence officer, to an Arab country to do what he has to do. He never comes back. No one knows what happens to him. The security apparatus, meaning Mossad and the Shin Bet, never say what happens to him. So this woman has no... His wife doesn't know if he's alive and made another life in somewhere. Doesn't know if he was captured by... It was actually in Syria and is living as, you know, a prisoner of war. Doesn't know if he was killed. She has no idea. And the security apparatus won't tell her anything. And after some crazy amount of time, I believe it was 20 years, she said, I can't take this anymore. And she had raised her children, right? But she wanted a divorce, a legal, a religious divorce, so she could move on with her life. She went to the religious courts multiple times. They would not grant her a get, what the document needed for the religious divorce. They would not grant it to her. Finally, she was able to bring it to the Knesset's attention. And there was someone within the Knesset who was not only a policy lawmaker, but also was able to draw her and connect her to different journalists who were then able to basically air her story on national media, which also got international attention. And no one wants to be the country, talk about internal fighting, where you're viewed as being, you know, discriminatory towards a particular group, right, women, of course, and having, and not providing full equality, and she couldn't be fully equal. And so after a succession of a lot of pressures from a lot of different sources, the religious court basically had no ability to not grant her the get anymore, and so she eventually was granted the get. But even when she brought it to the Supreme Court, and she brought it to the Supreme Court, not because she wanted a religious divorce from the Supreme Court, but to say that I have to have a guarantee that the religious courts will even hear me, and you, the Supreme Court, have to make sure that that happens and ensure that that happens. Even then, the Supreme Court said, we can't get involved. This is a religious personal status issue.
Oh.
So it's very complicated.
What if it only happened to women?
Why wouldn't
to men?
Yeah, no. Only women have the problem getting a divorce. It's only the women.
Doesn't the man have to agree to the divorce?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still the way it is.
Correct.
So if you have a husband who abuses you.
Correct.
That's right.
If he doesn't want to grant you divorce.
Then you will not get it from the religious court.
But you can go to Cyprus.
I don't know. Can you go to Cyprus?
No.
The
state won't recognize it because it's not a religious divorce.
But they would recognize the marriage?
The state recognizes the marriage.
But it won't recognize
the marriage. There was an article.
Correct.
If you got a beer down, it was like Brooklyn or somewhere. And there was a whole racket of
I think I read about these enforcers, right?
The women whose husbands wouldn't give them
the get. What's the point of the ultra-Orthodox not giving the get? What's their reasoning?
It's complicated. Well, it's first of all. Right. Well, not first of all, it depends upon which appointed religious leader, right, is making that decision. So there are some religious leaders who are much more lenient, meaning some rabbis who are much more lenient for the get. And so you try to get that rabbi, obviously. And there are those who you know who those are. There are some who are much more strict. So, again, it just depends. There's not only one, right? It's a slew of them. But they have control. And, of course, it's only men who are in that position, right? It's not. There are no ultra-Orthodox women rabbis who are making decisions over whether or not you can get the get. It's only men. So, again, all the more so when you're in an abusive relationship, not that it's not problematic anyway, but all the more so when you have those circumstances. But it's very complicated. There have been some movies over the last few years really exposing the controversy around the get. Because
there is.
There's a lot of pressure. But again, because of the way Israel's political system is set up, you have a ruling coalition. And if that coalition has a lot of influence from the National Religious Party and any of the political religious parties, and they are a major component of the coalition, then that is not going to change.
And they kind of have no reason to play nice, right?
Of course not.
Right, because they have all the power.
That's right.
It's hard to change. They increase the percentage, right, to get elected, right?
Yes.
They change the percentage. And
that's right.
And kind of carve some of this out. And there was... And then right before this thing changed, right, weren't they going to change the whole military funds group? Mm-hmm.
Yes, so what Evan's referring to is about 18 months, 2 years ago, the TAL law, T-A-L, the TAL law was up for, to be revisited, basically. And the TAL law was the law that said how many yeshiva students would be exempt from conscription. And already what had been discussed and what had been, had already basically been structured was that for those communities where service, so that means both Arabs and ultra-Orthodox Jews, where military service was not an option, there was an encouragement to create what was called Sheirut Le'umi, national service, both for Arabs and ultra-Orthodox Jews, men and women. And the idea being that even if they're not going to serve in the army, at least they could serve the state in some other way for a period of, you know, it just depended, but basically from anywhere from a year to 2 years. Military service is at least 3 for women, 4 for men, and can be longer, obviously. That's the basic service, though. So the idea of national service could be anything. It could be, you know, volunteering in a certain school district, working in a hospital, whatever it is. So if you're Arab, you wouldn't have to volunteer in the Jewish hospital. You could still volunteer, not that there's a Jewish hospital only, but right, but you could volunteer in your Arab sector, educational, whatever. But the idea is that you give back to society. The TAL law said, let's continue with that idea with Sheirut Le'umi for all of these populations who don't want to have military conscription and serve in the army, but also let's find a way to change or make it more enticing to those yeshiva students to actually serve in the army or do some sort of national service, but actually really encourage them to serve in the army rather than stay exempt. So Yedidya Stern, who works for the Israel Democracy Institute, and he's the one who was really, he's a modern Orthodox, a truly modern Orthodox person, who has been, I would say, on the forefront of really trying to create an actual constitution for the state of Israel, a written constitution, and what that would look like and what that would mean for the state, because there is no official constitution. Because, as we started this class, right, the religious would have a problem to it and object. Right, comes full circle. So the TAL law, the idea was that you would change the, by encouraging these people to be part of the system, to buy in even more, and then you do this through different levels of incentivizing. So some could be you provide a stipend even for continued education after they went into the army. Also, many of these people who are studying in the yeshivot really aren't going to be the, you know, Talmud Chacham. They're not going to be the smartest and brightest of the bright. They really need to get a job. And so part of what Yedidya was trying to say was, okay, how about if we incentivize it so you give your time to the army or to the state, and then if you want to study, you study part-time, and the other part-time you take practical skills kind of classes, vocational school and whatever it is, accounting, teaching, you know, whatever, and then you get a job. And you actually have to contribute to society, because the problem is you have this huge bubble, and this bubble is going to burst. And you have a population of the ultra-Orthodox community that is a major drain on the Israeli economy, because the Israeli economy has to pay for these people, sustain them. They have the highest birth rate, not counting the Arabs in Israel, which is actually decreasing, and they're still increasing, the ultra-Orthodox, and they're the most poor. They're the most poverty-stricken.
And so, with the least education.
Right, and so with the least education.
From the practical side.
Right, that's right. And so this becomes a huge drain on society, and so the TAL law was supposed to help at least begin to address this serious policy matter. And once the current coalition was in place, it basically was pushed to the side because the National Religious Party did not want it to be addressed and did not want to have to force these thousands of yeshiva students into the army. And Benjamin Netanyahu went with it because he needed the support of the coalition. So it's very complicated.
So the tall law is not in effect.
So the tall law right now is just sitting there and is just waiting for someone to...
But he was in power.
Yes. It wasn't so much that he even tried to get rid of it. If you, I mean, I never had the opportunity to ask, but I bet if someone were to ask Netanyahu, he would say, of course I would want these people not to be a drain on society. But when you partner with the National Religious Party, who has so much influence, and you want to keep your position as prime minister, you make unsavory compromises, I would say. Mm-hmm. And that would have been one of them.
Have a cabinet that was going out
right.
Downtown.
Right.
Immediately after.
Right. So this is, you know, this is one of those challenges.
You know what's also interesting is that the ultra-Orthodox rabbis will marry secular couples.
Sure, they don't care.
I know, I mean, when you think about it, and you think they wouldn't touch that.
Yeah, they don't care, though. I mean,
they don't.
Yeah. I mean, they care in that they would want these people to be religiously observant, but already they're, you know, they know that that's not necessarily a reality. So, yeah. So that is a separate conversation. We're actually going to keep coming to that in the next few weeks because part of this Jewishness conversation that's so important is that, like we said before, there is a lot of ambiguity in all of this. You know, David Ben-Gurion doesn't sit down and say, right, and identify who is a Jew. That question doesn't appear in the status quo. But that's going to become one of the most important issues, and we're going to see that in certain cases, like the Brother Daniel case that we're going to talk about in a couple of weeks, where you have these situations, whether around conversion or where people have decided to identify Jewishly, but they don't actually say that they're Jewish, or they converted from, or they didn't convert from Christianity, but and they were Jewish by a mother, but then they were part of Christianity. So what does that mean then? And right, it becomes very complicated. And a lot of that was ambiguous on the part of Ben-Gurion and the leadership on purpose. And the other part of that is that the reason it's ambiguous by them is because they say, we're not a theocracy. We don't have to decide who is a Jew, except you still have this parallel system at play with the religious leadership that actually, that conversation very much matters. So it's, yeah.
Well,
So you're going to marry a couple and have, I mean, I'm, we'll get to this, but how would they know if it's a Jew marrying a non-Jew? I mean, couldn't you just say you're both Jews and get married in Israel? And what about an Arab and a Jew? Because now in this modern world they're trying to be friends. Right, you have to actually show, and a lot of the, look, it's not for everyone. Right, so we're going to get there. But it is about, you actually in some cases have to demonstrate. So here's another, just one other like personal anecdotal story. So we have good family friends whose daughter married an American basketball player who was playing basketball in Israel. The American basketball player is African American from the South, born and raised, sounds very Southern, and is not Jewish. Okay? He marries the daughter of a conservative rabbi in Israel, Israeli. They could not get married in Israel by the religious ultra-Orthodox leadership. The father, I don't know if he performed the marriage, but they go out of the state to have a civil marriage. They come back, so the state recognizes the marriage. They have a daughter. She's Jewish because the mother's Jewish. This husband never converted to Judaism. He's played on almost every imaginable configuration of Israeli basketball teams. Sings Hatikva, sings the Shema to his daughter every night, celebrates Hanukkah, but is not Jewish. Okay? So again, it's complicated, right? And especially when you're in Israel, all the more so, because it's no, your identity with religion is so many pieces of this, right? It's not just your family, it's not just a religion, it's not just a culture, it's not just a tradition, now it's a politic, right? So it's all of these realms that are very hard to disentangle, which is also why I think it's fascinating, right? Because it makes it exciting in some ways, even though it's troubling and disturbing in other ways. But this is what, this is kind of what Israel is. No, and it's not American. I think one of the things just to walk away with right before we end, well, two things. I'll say two things because I have 5 minutes. Two things is the last piece of this, we did Kashrut, so just the last one is education. The important thing to know about education, and we've said this before, is that Ben-Gurion was not able to create an educational system, a public educational system, that would appeal to all of the sectors of the population, all of the different communities. So that's why you don't have a public educational system in the way that we do here in America. You do have schools that are governed by the state, but you have lots of other types of schools, which is why in this letter it says full autonomy of every stream in education will be guaranteed. And so the government will not take steps to take away any sort of religious consciousness. So Ben-Gurion recognized that he couldn't create a mandate that all students would go to X type of school, because there were going to be people who wanted to send their kids to a more observant school to only study these Talmudic Torah teachings versus practical skills, that kind of thing. So this is where Ben-Gurion would say, in some respects, that he was failed in creating some sort of civic national identity in terms of the educational system. Where then it comes into play, as we have said before, is in the army. And that's really where you have a civic education in the army. Because in theory, everyone's supposed to go, even though you still have these two population outposts that aren't going, right? The Haredim and the Arabs. So that's what happens with education. And the education system is very complicated, meaning different schools get funding from and subsidies from government. The Arab schools, just so you do know, also receive government subsidies and funding. The Christian schools that are Greek Orthodox also receive government funding. It doesn't mean necessarily, however, they're trying to tell us something, but it doesn't mean that it's fair and equal.
So it's not equal for
not them. Always. That's right. And much of it depends on local municipalities, not just top down. Okay, so that's one. And then the last thing I wanted to say, what was it? About status quo, what were we talking about? Maybe it wasn't so important.
The question,
it doesn't matter.
So it's how he never converted, but he lived that whole life, the basketball.
Oh, game. Yeah. Oh, I know. Got it. America and Israel. Okay? When we look at this issue, because we are so American, we look at it through the lens of church and state. And for us, those walls are high and impregnable. That is not the case for Israel. And so it's very hard for us to examine these issues without that lens, but we really do have to remove it a bit in order to understand some of the complexity of the religion and society issues within Israel. Because it's not a fair, it's not a fair counter to use America and Israel, because America really is the exception throughout the world in this issue of church and state. It is not the norm. Not that Israel is the norm, but America is not the norm.
And we're still
except
American.
That there are so many secular people in Israel who
sure.
Do nothing.
That's right. But also remember, and we'll talk more about this as we keep going, and this is where the Gutman reports come into play, because these reports are very interesting, because they're secular is not what we think of as Americans as secular. So secular to many of them is they're still observing Shabbat. So what does that mean? They have Shabbat dinner every Friday night, even if it means they go and play soccer Saturday morning. That they are always home or go to shul for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, even if they don't pray any other time. Right? So again, it's tangled, because some of it is cultural as well. All of them, the Gutman reports show that over 95% of Israeli Jews have a Seder. Yep. Now, it doesn't mean it's a religiously observant Seder, and who knows what some of those Seders look like, right? But they're there with their families having what they say are a Seder. Now, I'm sure it doesn't live up to the standards of an ultra-Orthodox Seder. But again...
or an American secular Seder.
Right, but again, so... that's right. So it's complicated. It's very complicated.
We had an Israeli fellow, and I had him come for break fast. And, like, when he just helped me, he says, doesn't matter. It's like, whenever I get done with work.
Exactly.
At the hospital.
That's right. That's right. So it just depends. It really just depends.
Is abortion considered a religious matter, or is it
civic? It's secular. It's civic. It's complete. And actually, on any kind of fertility issues, Israel is very liberal. Very liberal. That's complicated. No. No. Yeah. All right, thank you all very much, and I'll see you next week.